Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places, with your host, Adam Bronstein. Hello, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, I encourage you to X out of that. Pick up your smartphone and head over to your favorite podcasting app. Search on Wilderness Podcast. You'll find the green logo with the bear. You can subscribe to catch future releases, and you can pick up where you left off on this episode. You can also go back and listen to past episodes of the program. Thanks so much to all my listeners and supporters. This program has really grown, and I'm very grateful to everybody and all the support and emails that I receive. If you'd like to suggest a guest or a topic, you can always email me through the website at wildernesspodcast.com. There's a contact form. If you'd like to support the program, you can leave a review on Apple iTunes. That helps boost the visibility. You can also share this episode or another on your social media channels. Or you can go to wildernesspodcast.com/support. This program is completely supported by individual donations. I have expenses from hosting to equipment and travel. This is not a money-making proposition. I'm just looking to cover my costs. So thank you very much to my financial supporters. And if you're able to contribute, it's always greatly appreciated. In this episode, I interview James Brundage, an accomplished filmmaker, and he met me this summer up in the northern Greater Yellowstone ecosystem to help out with some filming projects that we're involved with. And I'm very grateful to James and his dedication to conservation, and he's really found a niche through filmmaking. James has worked with PBS, BBC, NBC, ABC, Turner, Discovery, and National Geographic, among others. And he's been at this for quite a while. In this episode, we talk about the California and Oregon wildfires, which were raging at the time we were meeting. The smoke had made it across to the northern Rocky Mountains where we were doing some filming, which is always a little problematic. We talk about the interconnectedness of the climate and biodiversity crisis, the impacts of climate change around the world, his life as a conservation filmmaker, film as the ultimate art form, his early years as a filmmaker, working with Robert Redford and his film Forever Wild, his important film Wild Ways, the organization he's involved with called Nature Needs Half, which seeks to protect over half of the Earth's land and ocean for biodiversity and climate resilience, the Club of Rome, and the Global Safety Net, among other topics. I hope you enjoy this episode. I had a great time meeting with James. And yeah, we've got a lot of great episodes in the pipeline, so stay tuned. Please subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you all.
So I used to teach audio recording for film at the New York Film Academy. That's an XY formation. There's three ways of doing stereo miking. That's XY. You can do this, you can do this, or you can do this. So that's the this way.
It's definitely always room for audio improvement. Especially on this program, but
yeah, okay.
I listen to other podcasts, and the audio is not bad. But sometimes I just I'll be too far away with my wireless mics; mm-hmm. They'll just be shielding.
Yeah.
Sometimes the acoustics are off. I just upped the bit rate a little bit on this. I think it's at 128.
Ooh, that'll do it.
But my program does something else to it after I export.
Oh, yeah, it won't be. It'll be probably 16 or 24-bit when you post it.
Thanks for chatting with me, James. We're here in the northern Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. The smoke has just arrived. What's on your mind when you see all this smoke?
Well, I came here to film the spectacular and important Gallatin Range, and it is now too smoky from the fires on the West Coast to even see it from a couple miles away. And that is distressing, it's appalling, and it's a clear signal that we are treating the planet very poorly. And the planet is starting to give us some feedback that things are not going very well.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about the fires, obviously, and we're used to smoke across the West, but we don't really have any major fires close to us. These are all coming across from Oregon and California. The satellite imagery is pretty unbelievable. The California wildfire, I forgot which one it was. It might be the Creek Fire, which is the largest now in California history. I might have gotten the name wrong, but the satellite signature of this fire is the largest that they've ever observed before.
I spoke to my colleague Harvey Locke in Banff National Park. He can't see the mountains there, and he's 1,000 kilometers from the fires. This is a globally significant event. And another horrible aspect of it is a huge deposit of carbon into the atmosphere, which is, you know, the problem that created the fires is global warming and climate change and the loss of soil moisture and the desertification of the entire ecosystem is now drier than it used to be. Therefore, these fires are bigger and more common, and they spread further and faster. So, you know, the concentration of carbon and the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere creates the problem, but now we're dumping a huge load, enormous. One of these big fires is an enormous carbon load. It's like a year's of driving in the United States is the carbon load from these fires. And that's just going to, that's one of the classic feedback loops. And the feedback loops are the least understood segment of climate change, and they are the most dangerous aspect of climate change.
Yeah, a lot of the feedback loops are not accounted for in the IPCC, and that's because we can't even identify all of them. We're still learning about new feedbacks all the time. I just learned about this new phenomenon called Atlantification in the Arctic. So you have this warm mass of water that's usually, you know, down towards the ocean floor, but now it's starting to bubble up, and it's coming within a couple hundred meters or 100 meters of the surface, and they even think that there's some interaction now. So this warm water is starting to really break apart that ice. And there was that Russian vessel that was just up there, and they were able to travel pretty much right to the North Pole. It's just a big slushy mess up there right now. So these are really fascinating times, and it's hard to ignore the smoke. And obviously, you know, weather is not climate, but when you get a lot of weather events over a period of time, that starts to connect the dots, and it can be defined as climate, and that goes with fires. And it's really disturbing to hear about all the denial out there right now, and everyone's blaming forest management.
Not everyone, only a few idiots are blaming forest management.
You're right, it's not everyone.
For these fires, it's only our idiot in chief.
The people who are the loudest, yeah. And that's what they're going for.
No, they're not the loudest, they're just the dumbest. I mean, the thing I'd like to point out is the connection between nature and climate. And the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis has been treated as two separate problems that we have to solve by two separate approaches and two separate sets of groups who are saying, well, we're working on climate, we're working on biodiversity. They are absolutely connected. I mean, the burning of nature by the climate, making the climate crisis worse, is a classic example. And the thing that we most need to do to confront the climate crisis is to grow trees and to restore degraded forests and to recreate the Earth's filtration system, which for many millions of years processed carbon dioxide very well and sequestered the carbon and made oxygen. But these filters are the best filters are known as forests. And we have to sort of preserve forests, restore the degraded forests, and create more trees rather than fewer trees. The even more important than the forests for climate, as far as climate is concerned, are the oceans. Two out of every three breaths that you take, the oxygen content
that you breathe two out of every three times is created by tiny creatures, microscopic creatures in the ocean. And that's another relationship between nature, biodiversity, and climate that shows that we are all in this very large interconnected system where the biodiversity and climate are absolutely interrelated.
So the CO2 we're pumping in the atmosphere, and with all of our feedback loops now that are, you know, kicking off methane, which breaks down into carbon, and all these other feedback loops that are pumping more carbon, most of that heat is being absorbed by the ocean. I forgot the stat, but if without our oceans, we would have already burned up by the amount of CO2 that we've pumped in and all the warmth that's been trapped.
The figure is 3/4.
Okay. So it's a lot, and it's really scary. And the oceans are heating up so quick. The our fisheries right now in the Arctic are virtually collapsing. Like, they had to shut down the cod fishery, and salmon runs are getting smaller. The ocean conditions are very important for anadromous fish. We're seeing biodiversity collapse across the globe. What happens with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and how does that end up in the oceans? Like, what's going on there?
Well, the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean because there's a big interchange between the atmosphere and the ocean. It's increasing the acidity of the ocean, which has two serious impacts. One, it reduces the calcium carbonate that is available to all these microscopic creatures who use the calcium carbonate to build their shells and to survive. If the ocean becomes too acidified, they die, and there goes our oxygen supply. It also reduces the dissolved oxygen in the water, and now there's some recent studies that showing that some pelagic fish populations, that's fish populations in the open ocean, are suffocating because there's not enough dissolved oxygen for them to breathe.
And I'm throwing out stats again, but it's something like 60% of the human population gets most of their protein from the oceans right now. Once this wild food source is gone, you know, it's just another layer. And it's pretty crazy time to be alive, for sure. Just watching all of this unfold around us. If I met you at a cocktail party, asked who you are and what do? What would you say to me?
I'm a conservationist. I'm an environmental journalist, and I'm a nature filmmaker. I started out as a young man making adventure films and climbing big mountains and running wild rivers for National Geographic and others. In the last 20 to 25 years, I've focused exclusively on films about nature conservation, working with conservation groups and conservation biologists who are working in the field trying to save the last best parts of nature.
And where did you go to school?
I studied music and film scoring at the Berklee College of Music. And that was my first career. I was in New York as a performing musician and writing music for television. But because of my love of the outdoors, I started having opportunities to make outdoor films, and my connections in the film industry came together. And that was a better path for me because I could indulge my love of nature and the outdoors and adventure travel and art. And film turned out to be I was better at making film than at making music because film is the ultimate sort of jack-of-all-trades art. It combines so many aspects, and that's kind of who I am. I'm a jack of many trades.
Storytelling, the technical side, art, right? Music.
Photography, music, the written word, the spoken word. Mm-hmm. And the film is the ultimate combination of all those things, and that turned out to be a better match for my particular talents.
What was editing like back when you first started? I mean, it wasn't Adobe Premiere Pro.
I worked on a film flatbed, which was taking chunks of film and...
Like actual film?
Yes, and gluing them together. And it took hours, you know, to make a single edit was, you know, a chore. You'd have to wind the film to the scene you wanted to select, mm-hmm. and cut it with your razor blade, and then wind it to the end of that scene you want to get, cut it with a razor blade, hang that up somewhere, and then go find the film reel that you're cutting to, put that back on the flatbed, take the little piece of film that you just cut out from the other reel and tape it together into your reel. And that's how you made a film.
So thinking back on your career, what was the most memorable project that you worked on, or what really accelerated your career and your path?
Gosh, I have been very fortunate to work all over the world in some of those fantastic places and with some of the most fantastic people. It's hard to pick one. My first high-level opportunities happened working with my good friend Dave Brashears, who figured out we could get paid to climb Mount Everest if we could haul a film camera up Mount Everest. And with my music background, I worked as his sound recordist on Mount Everest. And so that was what opened doors, because he got the camera to the summit, we got some nice footage, and we got noticed by the industry, and that got us on the A-list at National Geographic, and that opened a lot of doors. Similarly, doing some work on Mount Everest, I made my first film for Nova PBS, and that opened a lot of doors, and I've been able to follow up since.
When did you move from adventure or even just scenery to more of a conservation-based film project?
I have always been passionate about conservation, and I made a few short films along the way. I got married, and I had a baby, and it wasn't okay to go off and do things where people die. So I said, you know, I got to remember that my daughter was 6 months old, and I got a call from Alex Lowe to go make a film on Shishipangma. And I said, let me think about it. I called back the next day, said, you know, I can't do that. I have a dependent now. Someone's depending on me. I have to come back. So I turned that down. As it turns out, Alex and two members of his film crew were killed on that expedition film shoot.
You were going to go on that?
I chose not to. Wow. So that was a really good decision. And that was the moment when I said no more of that. And I was in the middle of a conservation film at the time called Subdivide and Conquer, about a PBS show about land use in the West. And I just poured myself into that. And that's all I've done ever since, is conservation and nature films.
That accident was big news everywhere, especially in the climbing community. But wow, that's I guess that's a pretty close call there. Yeah,
I've had a couple of those, all of which confirmed my decision to, and you know, I was 45 years old. I'd survived some close calls. I had some wonderful climbs and first descents of wild rivers that were risky, and most of us survived. I did. So I just kind of had that t-shirt, and I was happy to be a responsible father and you know, stop doing stuff where people died.
Yeah, I've left the climbing world too. I lost a friend on Rainier when I was really young. And I continued climbing after that, but it was just never the same. My head wasn't into it. But, you know, that's something that...
Was that in the ice fall?
It was on the ice fall.
Yeah.
It was on, I think it was on Emmons Glacier, but they just summited, or attempted to summit when it was way too icy. They didn't go when it was a little softer. So when they slipped and fell, they couldn't self-arrest, and they fell into a crevasse, basically.
Ouch. I made two films on Rainier, mm-hmm. and lost a colleague there, so I understand.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. But I look back on my climbing memories, and I wouldn't replace them for the world. You know, it's kind of one of those things. It's like I'm glad I I don't want to say survive, like you're going into battle per se, but that's just part of the deal. You know, you're going out and it's part of the deal. So I'm glad that my brain doesn't need that anymore. I feel like I've really slowed down, even though I'm just, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, I'm not old, but I feel like I've been able to really slow down and I don't need to go bag peaks anymore and run around like crazy. I really notice the little things a lot more, so.
You know, that's more appropriate for 25-year-olds who are still loaded up with testosterone. us older guys have more judgment.
We used to bag peaks in the Adirondacks, and we would do these 24-hour climbs. And I don't know how we didn't crash the car on the drive home. Everyone was just so tired and so irresponsible. But anyways, we had a good time. Tell me about your film with Robert Redford.
That film was called Forever Wild. We made that for PBS. And it was the story of citizen volunteers who make the wilderness areas around the country. The Wilderness Act was a brilliant piece of legislation that called for the absolute protection of a piece of land through an act of Congress. Well, to get an act of Congress, you have to lobby congressmen, you have to do a tremendous amount of work in surveying land and documenting the natural values of that land and making a strong case for the protection of that land. And where that happened, and the way that happened, was through the dedicated work of citizen volunteers who just loved the place and said, we need to protect this. So we found a few of these stories around the country of these really dedicated citizens who found a place they loved and worked for 10 or even 20 years in one case to get it protected as wilderness. And we wanted to share that story, and we found three stories around the country, one in the Rocky Mountains, one in the East Coast, in the Wild River Range in New Hampshire, and one in California, the King River Wilderness, all which were made by the long dedicated efforts of citizen volunteers.
We need more of that today, and not just in wilderness. We need it everywhere. We need this greater good and greater cause to fight for. And it's always interesting because, you know, people think of wilderness and the Forest Service as being the stewards, and yeah, they're there to manage it, but it's always been individuals, and a lot of times it's individuals inside of the agencies, but it's the hard work and dedication of conservation volunteers who are doing this. So every wilderness area that you visit, there's a story behind it. And you know, I'm not going to knock the Forest Service too much, but today they like to tout their old employees like Bob Marshall and Aldo Leopold as being these visionaries who worked for the Forest Service. But what they don't tell you is that they weren't treated the best when they were working for these agencies, and they were often put down and shoved aside. But they had that vision, and they pushed through, and today we're the beneficiaries of that. So I'm very grateful to all the volunteers and the passionate people out there who are working to protect what we have left, because we still do have some opportunities. So the story does continue out there, and it's playing out today all across the country. All those unsung heroes who are working to protect our remaining roadless lands. Tell me about Wildways. That's another great film of yours.
Well, as we were making Forever Wild, I came to understand that these wilderness areas and these national parks, what Ken Burns called America's best idea, were necessary but not sufficient. That I came to understand, working with these biologists and conservationists, that nature is a large network. Nature needs to be connected to itself. These little islands of habitat, if left as little islands, will become islands of extinction. And that for nature to really survive and to thrive, that these wonderful wilderness areas and national parks need to be connected together as they used to be before the human domination of the earth. So I started working with Harvey Locke, who created this wonderful vision of a network of corridors connecting Yellowstone National Park through to the Selway Bitterroots, through to Glacier National Park, across the border to Banff National Park in Canada, and all the way up to the Yukon. A network of protected areas and corridors running up the spine of the Rocky Mountains called Yellowstone to Yukon. And we were going to make that the final chapter of Forever Wild, but I came to realize this was too important an idea. It really needed its own film. So that grew into Wild Ways, which is the story of Yellowstone to Yukon. And above that, it's the story of the founder of this idea, Michael Soule, who created what we call conservation biology, and also created what we call connectivity conservation, which is this understanding that nature needs to be networked in order to survive. So I looked at the work of Michael Soule, he was in the film, and then I looked at connectivity projects around the world in the United States, Canada, and Africa. We glanced at a couple of connectivity projects in the Himalayas and in Australia as well.
Tell me about Nature Needs Half.
Nature Needs Half is the big picture vision of what we need to do to have a functioning, healthy planet into the infinite future. We need to protect at least half of the planet, and that includes the oceans and all the waters around the planet. In order for nature to function in this as this large connected network that it is and that it needs to be and it needs to function without this interruption of humans, which have cut off nature into these little packets of isolated habitat. And that just doesn't work in the long term. We need to protect enough of the planet that nature can thrive. And it also is a key element in averting the climate catastrophe. The best thing we could do for climate is to protect a lot of nature. Forests and natural areas are the filters of the planet that sequester carbon, they turn carbon dioxide into oxygen, and make a whole healthy functioning ecosystem. And it's a huge connection between biodiversity and climate. The best thing we could do for climate is to protect forests and other biodiversity.
Sounds like a pretty radical idea. How do we pull it off?
You know, I like to think that we're not functioning on the radical fringe, that this is the first best idea that we all need to understand. And my entire efforts as an environmental journalist are about trying to communicate this to a general public, for people to understand that, you know, the world is a large interconnected network that humanity is an intrinsic part of, and that we need healthy nature to have a healthy humanity. Look what's happening now with the pandemic, with the fires, with the climate catastrophe. All of this is about a world that is deeply compromised by human interference. And we need to take a step back and understand that in order to save ourselves, we have to save nature and the planet that we live on.
It's a big task.
It's a huge task. It's an enormous task, and it is the most important task of our time. Mm-hmm. We have spent the last century and a half absolutely subduing the planet. And we have overdone it, and we are looking at the consequences. Unless we turn this deal around very quickly at this point, many people estimate the tipping point of no return is about 2030. That's pretty soon as far as these things go. Unless we really turn this deal around, we are headed for an ecosystem collapse and a climate catastrophe that is bigger and worse than most people are willing to even talk about. One of the problems here is people who, the truth is so kind of overwhelmingly bad, anyone who talks about it in that way is quickly painted as an extremist, as a radical. But sorry, it is not extreme. This is the science behind all this. I made a science film for the Nova series in 1997 called Warnings from the Ice. We looked at ice cores from all over Antarctica, and they were showing huge climate shifts happening much faster than anyone understood. So we are on the brink of absolute systemic collapse.
And it could be very abrupt as well. And that's what the geological or the ice cores are telling us.
These systems can flip much faster than anyone thought. Mm-hmm. These scientists were pulling up these ice cores going, oh my God, we see these huge shifts in tens of years. We thought they took tens of thousands of years, and they can happen in a couple of decades. Well, a couple of decades is 2040, and that is when a recent scientific paper predicted a high probability of systemic collapse.
Was that the Club of Rome paper? Was that the limits to growth?
The Club of Rome paper, that was from the 60s. And the Club of Rome paper, very famous paper called The Limits to Growth, you know, suggested we were going to outpace our consumption and population, we're going to outpace the planet's ability to support us. That paper was widely derided for many years and basically buried because we discovered many more oil reserves. There was the so-called Green Revolution, which was massive input of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, which allowed us to grow a lot more food. So we were able to outpace the limits that the Club of Rome observed by growing more food and finding more petrochemicals. But unfortunately, the only thing they got wrong was the dates. We are now facing the collapse that the Club of Rome predicted. It's just 2030, not 1995.
I was just looking at the graph in the 2020, and it has all the lines for like population and then standard of living and natural resources, and it's off a little bit, but it's not off that much.
I know. It is.
It's pretty accurate to where we are today.
There was a bump because we found a lot more oil. Mm-hmm. Now with fracking, we've found more places we can get gas. Mm-hmm. And we could grow more food faster, but growing more food faster was the creation of this huge petrochemical industrial monoculture, which is a huge part of the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. So we've talked here about biodiversity as a solution to the climate crisis. There is the energy use, which everyone knows about, you know, our pouring carbon into the atmosphere to make electricity with coal and oil. But the third leg of that is agriculture. And our system of industrial petrochemical monoculture is a huge source of carbon. And that needs to be absolutely reversed. If we use our soils well, they can become carbon sinks rather than carbon sources. If you build organic soils with bugs and worms and all sorts of microbiota, store carbon. But right now we're using the entire Midwest of America as a sponge to accept fertilizers from which we grow a lot of corn. And we actually put more calories in petrochemical energy into an acre than we get out of in food energy. So that whole system has to utterly change and utterly reverse to turn agriculture from a source of carbon dioxide to a carbon sequestering system, which is what regenerative organic agriculture does.
And when we start to run out of oil, I mean, the whole system collapses unless we address it, you know, start coming up with these new methods now.
We've got all the methods. We have everything we need to do. You know how much solar energy hits the planet every day? We harvest the solar energy. We harvest the wind energy. We harvest the geothermal energy. It's all here. It just requires the will to do it. And this skewed set of subsidies that allows the carbon companies to still make vast amount of energy while dumping all the waste products into our common global commons of the atmosphere and the ocean.
So energy production is one issue, but back to agriculture. So the amount of natural gas or an oil that's used to make fertilizers, the energy that goes into running the machinery, processing, transporting, storing, and then, of course, the waste removal after. It's just this energy suck.
Yeah.
And it scares the daylights out of me.
Well, it ought to. It's truly scary. I'd like to call your attention and your listeners' attention to a website called One Earth, which is doing some of the best thinking in this regard that I know of. And they have organized their thinking into three platforms. One is nature needs half. We need to protect half of the planet. The second stool of saving our planet from more than 1.5 degrees of warming is 100% renewable energy by 2050. And the third leg is an absolute change of our agricultural practices from petrochemical-based to regenerative agriculture that store carbon rather than releasing it. So those are the three legs that we have, and they've got the science on that website that shows you the only way to stay this side of 1.5 degrees is to do all three of these things all at once, starting right now. Across the Earth, 15% of the terrestrial areas are under some form of protection.
How much?
15%. We need to go to 50, and it is completely doable. And the science team at Nature Needs Half has just published a paper called The Global Safety Net, which demonstrates exactly how and where we can do this. It designates, in addition to the 15% of the planet that is already protected, we have to add another 35%. 6% of that is the wilderness areas that are not yet protected. And that's what we're working for here in the Gallatin Range in Montana for the Act Local portion of this global thought. A large percentage, and I've forgotten the number, is indigenous lands, which hold a huge proportion of the intact nature around the planet. And I'm talking about the tribal lands in the Amazon. I'm talking about many indigenous territories in northern Canada. Indigenous people control a huge section of important, biologically important areas, and we need to work with them to make sure these places are not trashed. The other important areas that the Global Safety Net imagines are the places of rare species, endangered rare species, and that's only 2%. There's only 2% of the world. If we add that to our current set of protected areas, we will protect most of the critically endangered species in the world. So that's an easy job that should be done right away. Then there's another percentage, and I don't recall these numbers off the top of my head.
I can't keep all the percents straight.
Which we call carbon stabilization areas, which are forests and grasslands and mangroves, which are really important areas for sequestering carbon.
The federal government owns around 640 million acres of land. It's about 28% of the 2.7 billion acres of land in the United States. So it's quite a bit. And, you know, it's also like how we're using these lands, right? So there's the land use component of grazing and unsustainable forestry practices, and one could argue that all forestry or cutting is unsustainable in many ways, but that's a whole other topic. So it's not just setting the lands aside and saying that they're protected in name only. You have to actually manage them in such a way. So what's the thinking there?
I'm going to pull up a PowerPoint show that I just wrote. This is the first draft, because this paper just came out last week. But it has all those numbers in it. so I can, and it'd be much better to just actually use the numbers and go, well, around. My colleagues at Nature Needs Half have just published what I believe to be one of the most important studies really ever. It's a big statement, but they've published a study of many years' effort called the Global Safety Net, which has mapped the entire world ecoregion by ecoregion, dividing to 846 separate ecoregions, and analyzed what part of the world we need to protect to reverse the extinction crisis and stabilize climate. And they have suggested that we need to protect about 50% of the planet in order to accomplish these two things. Currently, we have about 15% of the world is in protected area. There needs to be another 2% to have sites of species rarity, really highly endangered rare species. And that's a very small addition to what we have already preserved. And this needs to happen right away, because these are rare species on the brink of extinction. Then they've analyzed and found these distinct species assemblages, which are gatherings of animals and plants, which create a real cascade of biodiversity. That's about 6% of the planet they have identified as distinct species assemblages. They've also identified about 6% of the planet for rare phenomena. They've identified 16% of the planet as unspoiled natural areas that are not yet protected. In addition to that, they have found about 5% of the world needs to be protected as climate stabilization areas. These are important forests and grasslands and mangroves that sequester carbon and help stabilize our climate. You add all these up and you get to be about half the planet that needs to be protected to conserve biodiversity and sustain a stable climate. We have protected about 15% of terrestrial areas. And this particular study only examines terrestrial areas. We have protected about 3.5% of the ocean, and that needs to grow by a lot. Those are called marine protected areas, or MPAs, and they are an extremely successful conservation strategy. They end up protecting fisheries, because you need no-take zones where fish can breed. And one of the great problems in the ocean is that big old fish lay a lot more eggs than young adult fish. But we're killing all the big old fish. So we need these marine protected areas where we can have big old fish laying lots of eggs and then really saving our fisheries by having these places where we choose not to fish.
And you read success stories about that. Even like today, recently, was it Atlantic cod are starting to come back?
I hadn't heard that. The cod fishery was shut down 30 years ago because it completely collapsed from overfishing.
We might cut this part out because, again, I'm not remembering the numbers. But anyways, we are seeing cases of localized fishery rebounds, and it's directly correlated with these marine protected areas.
Absolutely. Great example of that is in the Sea of Cortez, where they created a marine protected area, and it totally rejuvenated their fisheries and helped the marine mammal population. It was a huge success story.
So how do we make up the 35% needed for the terrestrial environment?
Okay, I'm going to go back to my notes.
Hey, if you got the notes, that's great.
All right. So, of the 35% of the world that needs to be protected, about 2% are rare species sites, where there are these highly endangered, very rare species that will vanish if we don't protect these fairly small area right away. That needs to happen right away. There's about 6% of the planet is extreme high biodiversity areas. A great example of that is the Andean slopes, which go from 12,000 feet down to 100 feet above sea level and the Amazon basin, and the biodiversity of this huge of these areas is the highest biodiversity in the world. So these are some sites, a lot of them in South America, a lot in the Himalayan slopes, extreme high diversity that need protected, about 6% of the planet. There are large mammal landscapes, and large mammals are really the indicator species of the health of an entire ecosystem. They've identified 6% of the world, which are large mammal landscapes which need to be protected. Intact wilderness is something that we really have to keep. There's about 16% of the world is unspoiled wilderness areas that are not in any form of protection, and we need to protect them. We need to keep every roadless area in the world still roadless. Roads are an infection. When you build a road, timbering, killing the animals, mineral extraction, and settlement quickly follow, and building a road into any roadless area is the beginning of the end. Yeah. There are very few roadless areas in the world. If you look at the map of all the world with all the roads, it's covered. It's very hard to get any place on the whole planet where you're more than 10 miles from a road. So any of the roadless areas that we have, we need to keep.
Every acre.
Every single one. That's about 16% of the planet. And then there's about 5% of the planet that they've identified as climate stabilization areas, where there are natural areas, mangroves, grasslands, forests, that we need to keep in order to protect our climate. These are places where carbon is sequestered, oxygen is produced, water is filtered, and we are given the health of our landscape. These are called ecosystem services in conservation talk. But that's what the Earth does for us in providing pure air, oxygen, clean water, and arable soils. The other thing we need to recognize is that a huge portion of these lands that need protection are occupied by indigenous people. They need to be absolutely part of the solution. We need to work with indigenous people all over the world, from Africa, especially in the Amazon, and in the northern regions of Siberia and Canada, where indigenous people control these huge areas that are very big carbon pools.
Does it say specifics about the U.S. in this report and where we're at now?
The global safety net has broken down these requirements for each country. I can't give you the figures, absolute figures for the United States, but I can give you a document that has all of those numbers.
So a lot of most of our public lands outside of wilderness and roadless areas are under the multiple use mandate, and we've talked a lot about this on this program, but so they are considered by many to be quote-unquote protected, but in fact there's a lot of extraction and use that's going on there that is very bad for carbon cycles and is destructive of biodiversity. Does this report address specific uses on our public lands?
It doesn't go into that level of detail, but people in the conservation world recognize that there are two phases and two key elements to protection. One is defining a protected area, and two, every bit as important, is managing that area so it is actually protected. And a lot of that has to do with budgets for patrolling and enforcement, and that's a problem all over the world, especially in developing nations who have some great natural resources and some of these beautiful parks, but they don't have the funding to patrol them, to stop the poaching, to stop the extraction. So in addition to defining a protected area, you need to actually protect it, and that requires will and money.
Given your long film career and the trajectory of your career, how are you using film now to support these causes that you believe in so strongly?
Well, for many years, I worked in broadcast television, and I had some good placements with PBS Nova, with National Geographic, with BBC. I've made shows for several of the other networks over the years. And that worked very well to distribute our messages. But broadcast television is going away. Everything is going to the net. Everything is going to streaming. So now I am making media for web channels and social media and websites in support of these conservation groups that I'm working with. So I'm hoping that my media can help support these efforts and improve public knowledge of the need for conservation and improve funding for the people who are doing the very hard work in the trenches all over the world.
What motivates you and inspires you every day to get up and do this work?
I'm motivated by, you know, I ask myself that question every day. You know, how do I get out of bed and work really hard when, you know, I'm watching the world falling apart? It's really a challenge. What motivates me is hope. And also the fact that we are really at the gate. We're very near the point of no return. We need to do this now, or we really are done for. We've got about 8 or 10 years, depending on who you talk to, before we reach a point of no return. So it's now or never. This is the most important work. This is the most important task of the 21st century, is to rein in this out of control industrial system that we are using, that is not on purpose, completely by accident, but it's ruining the planet. And the most important task of the 21st century is to rein in this out of control technology and figure out a way of living here that is truly sustainable and can help us live here into the forever future. So I guess what motivates me on the good days most, not just fear of death, but it is the vision of what a beautiful, fantastic, sustainable world could be, with renewable energy, with large sections of nature that are thriving, that we could all experience either in person or just with the wonderful knowledge that nature is there and thriving. And with an agricultural and a food production system that is truly sustainable, that makes healthy food without ruining the planet. So, you know, there's a really good way that we could be living here. And it's that vision of that positive future is the best motivation.
This is our home.
This is our home. It's the only one. We can't live on Saturn.
So tell us about your short film, Our Home. I really enjoyed that.
My new web channel is Our Home, Poems and Prayers for the Planet. And it was inspired by a short piece I made that grew out of a meeting with some of the wonderful conservation thinkers from all over the world. And we convened what we call the Global Biodiversity Narrative to try and look for a story that we can all share that helps people understand how much we need a healthy planet and how we need to live here in a respectful, gentle, cooperative way so humans can thrive in cooperation with a thriving nature and a thriving planet. Very often, the economy, we are given this false choice that said, well, you either can have jobs and a big, healthy economy, or you can have a nice environment. And that is a complete lie. It is a complete, absolute, false choice. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. And without a fully functioning, healthy planet, we will not have a healthy, functioning economy. All of this needs to go together in a new vision of how we live here on the world. We need a better relationship with the planet. Right now, it is a really nasty, exploitative relationship of absolute domination. And that never works in the long run. Nature is our partner. We are part of nature. Nature is part of us. We have to live here in a respectful fashion, not in a fashion of absolute domination.
So if people want to watch your films or learn about Nature Needs Half and any other organizations that you're affiliated with, do you want to give some websites or other information for people to look?
You can find all of these links and many of my recent work on Our Home, Poems and Prayers for Our Planet. The URL is ourhomeplanet.us. And there are links there to some of these other groups that I support, namely Nature Needs Half and One Earth and the Global Safety Net.
Okay. Thanks for your time, James, and thanks for all the work that you do in the world. It really was inspiring, and your films are top-notch.
Thank you very much. I'd like to talk about one other thing. As we come to understand that the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis are completely connected, some of my colleagues have imagined that what one of the things and the tools that we need is a Paris Climate Accord for biodiversity. So they have authored what we call the Global Deal for Nature, which we are taking through the UN framework of the Convention on Biological Diversity to try and get that signed on an international level to create the same agreement that we have to try and protect the climate. We will have a similar international agreement to try and protect biodiversity. And we're calling that the Global Deal for Nature.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.